fix this problem.
He says he hopes that's an understanding that comes out of the beer summit. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
The Labor Department says the number of Americans filing new claims for unemployment benefits rose last week. The Labor Department says new claims rose by 25,000 to a seasonally adjusted 584,000. At the same time, the number of people still on the jobless benefit rolls dropped to the lowest level since mid-April. Those continuing to claim benefits fell by 54,000 to 6.2 million in the week that ended July 18th. That's the third straight week that continuing claims declined. Oil prices are rising. Benchmark crude for September delivery up $1.17 at more than $64 a barrel. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. From 2000 until 2007, in that period, trade between China and Africa jumped from $10 billion to $70 billion. China is now Africa's second largest trading partner. It used to be France. They are now number two behind the United States. And there are some people who think that it won't be that long before China overtakes the United States and becomes Africa's number one trading partner. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll talk about why the Chinese have done this, something about how they have done this, what they think they have to gain here, and what the countries of Africa think that they have to gain. And our guest for the program is a French journalist who is the co-author of a newly published book. The title is China Safari on the Trail of Beijing's Expansion in Africa, and it's published by Basic Books. Serge Michel was until recently the West Africa correspondent for the French newspaper Le Monde. He's worked as a journalist in Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Balkans. He's now based in Geneva. And he has been spending some time here in the United States talking about the book, and we're very pleased that he could be joining us. He's with us by telephone. As we talk, of course, questions, as always, are welcome. All we ask of callers is that people are brief, so we can get in as many as we can. And also, we hope people will stay on the topic, but certainly questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So questions, comments are welcome. Again, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers at any point here. If you'd like to get involved in our conversation, you certainly are welcome to do that. Well, Serge Michel, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Welcome. No problem. I'm very pleased to come and to see that there is an interest in America for this China-Africa phenomenon.
Well, I think certainly there is. And I think our feeling was, as we have read stories about this from time to time over time, that was certainly something that was worth talking about and hadn't gotten the level of attention probably that it should have. I think what's really striking here is, and as you report that, you know, over time, Europeans and Americans and their governments became discouraged with their experiences in Africa and that their involvement waned. But over that, perhaps that same period of time or after that, the Chinese became very involved in Africa, yeah. Very interested, say maybe beginning in the mid-1990s. Was this something that was a deliberate effort on the part of the Chinese government?
Yeah, well, there is a decision that can be tracked down to 1995. It was the time that the Chinese government asked the big Chinese companies to become global players. And and for them, Africa represents the ideal testing ground. You know, they can go there and they can observe their competitors and they can outbid them because they are cheaper. So these Chinese companies wanting to become global players went first to Africa And then they might show up soon in North America or in Europe. And I can well imagine them one day building a skyscraper in New York.
So this is an, if you ask this question, why did the Chinese do it or why did they benefit? There are a number of answers, and I'm sure we'll talk about all of them. But one of them, as you say, clearly is they're learning how to work and how to compete in the global marketplace by doing this.
Sure. It's not the main reason. The main reason is obviously they need to fuel their amazing growth, and they need a lot of raw materials that Africa has in plenty. I mean, they need oil, they need timber, they need copper, they need uranium, and many other metals. They are coming late for that, because the best pieces of the cake, African cake, if you can say so, have been taken already by American and European companies. So Chinese are arriving, and they have to find their way to the and find the access to these raw materials. So in order to ease the governments and please the governments and get access, they are exchanging raw materials they get against infrastructure they built. Mm. And that's a very new scheme. I mean, Europeans and Americans used to buy a lot of things in Africa or to extract it themselves and pay money in cash to rulers. But that would end up in the pockets of African ministers and rulers, and which is quite a corrupted place. So it wouldn't really benefit the people. But the Chinese come and they do it against a bridge or a dam or a road, railway. And that is maybe more useful for the usual African. That's another reason. I mean, raw materials access is really important for them. But also, you know, Africa is consists of 53 countries, mm-hmm. and China has no colonial past, has no France, when it goes to Africa, when it concerns Africa, has a former colonial territory which consists of Brazzaville, Congo, Senegal, Guinea, Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, and everything. But and they only go to these places right now. The British, they go to their former colonies as well in Zambia, in South Africa, and everywhere. But the Chinese, they don't have a colonial past, so they can go everywhere, and they do. And they go to these 53 countries, and they get friends with their governments. They help them. They finance them. And having these friends, I mean, 53 is a lot. And when you go to the UN at the assembly and you have 53 countries voting with you, it makes you a very powerful country. So there is also a desire for Chinese desire to become a world power through political influence in Africa.
And I think that's a very interesting point, and something that I think has gotten some attention. And that is, this is also a piece, perhaps, of a larger Chinese plan to build goodwill around the world and to enhance its reputation. And it's something that they have done in a variety of ways in Africa, in part by investing money there. But perhaps there are some other things that they have done as a way of trying to make friends and then helping to build a kind of a power base, at least in terms of goodwill, around the world.
And lastly, because there are many also other reasons, but Africa for them is a vast untapped market for the cheap goods. You know, China is producing everything, as you know, it's the factory of the world right now. But they have expensive things that they ship to the U.S., and they have cheap goods that they either sell in China or export to Africa. And you could see now a huge difference. If you go to the African markets in Dakar or in Johannesburg, you can buy Japanese motorbikes for $700, but you can buy the Chinese model half the price. Or you can buy the German fridge $500, or you can buy the Chinese model for a third of the price. And they have broken monopolies in these markets of home appliances, of even shoes, whatever you can name it. I mean, they have imported to Africa, and it has really made a difference. Africans now, with a dollar, can buy more thanks to China.
Well, that's a there. I'm sure, though, there is a negative there for African businesses, African manufacturers, because now they have to, they may have to be trying to compete with something that they had, they formerly were producing, but also now is available, produced in China, imported by the Chinese, available for sale at a much lower price. This must be really hard on some domestic industries.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is, especially for textile industry. You know, the manufacturing in Africa has never been really developed, so they are not all the sectors are not covered. But textile did exist in Africa for a long time, in countries like South Africa, Zambia, and it has really been damaged by the flood of Chinese imports. But the thing is, how do you want to protect Africa? I mean, these Chinese textiles have come to Europe and to the United States also massively. I mean, the regulations, the World Trade Organization's regulations have really opened the borders for them. So it's not really possible to protect Africa under specific regulations because it is Africa, because it's more fragile. I mean, it had to be a shock, and it has been a shock. I mean, I think that 80,000 people lost their job in South Africa in a month the day they opened the borders to Chinese textile. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Serge Michel. He was, until recently, West Africa correspondent for the French newspaper Le Monde and is the co-author, one of the authors, of a recently published book titled China Safari, which takes a look at the involvement of China in Africa. The book is published by Nation Books, just out recently. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. If you talked about the fact that China, unlike the countries of Europe, has no colonial legacy in Africa, but if you look at what the Chinese are doing, their pattern of resource extraction, their shipping in Chinese goods, the way that the Chinese live in Africa while they're there, one might ask, is this a kind of colonialism?
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, this process of extracting raw materials from Africa and then sending their manufactured goods, this is clearly a colonial scheme. I mean, the British and the French have been doing this in the past. But the China does not want to lead countries there in Africa, doesn't consider Africa a province or a territory of its own, depending on Beijing, you know. Mm-hmm. They at the opposite, they just very much respect the local powers, the local governments, and try to enhance them. So there is not a political project, but there is a business project. But, you know, this question is has very many faces. For example, the West has been colonizing Africa for a few centuries. But then, after independence, the West became post-colonial and very advanced in helping Africa with handouts and humanitarian actions and emergency actions when there was a drought or there was a famine when people have nothing to eat. But at the end, after 40 years, the Africans clearly saw that the West couldn't make the difference. I mean, with all the attention that the West was paying to Africa, it didn't make any difference. I mean, it didn't really help Africa to get out of misery. Although the Chinese, 30 years ago, were underdeveloped country, maybe at the same level like some African countries right now. And in 30 years, they really took 400 million people out of poverty. They really experienced an amazing development in China. So they are coming to Africa and they say, you know, we know what is misery, we know what is development, we know what you need to develop yourself, and we are ready to share our recipes with you. So in this case, Africans tend to believe China can do the difference.
You know, I think it's one of the things that's striking here is that, and you talk about this, that the Africans have seen people from Europe and people from the United States come with all sorts of agendas, both governments and non-government organizations. They want to exploit, they want to help. That it seems that for the Africans, it's almost a little bit refreshing that the Chinese simply are there for business. They're simply there to make money.
Yeah, there is a moral dimension in the Western approach of Africa. I mean, but, you know, as a ministerial in Congo told us, you cannot eat democracy. And it really boils down to this. Many Africans are fed up with the West preaching about democracy, good governance and human rights, but just failing to make a difference. So the Chinese do not come with ideology. They are not coming to help. They are coming to make business. And there is something in the aid business, in the aid, when you help someone, you still control him. But when you do business, you have a partner, and you are in a win-win relationship. So this propaganda is very much attractive for Africans. Mm.
We have a caller here, and we expect we'll have others, but we'll start in with our first, someone in Carbondale, down in the southern part of Illinois. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes. Hello. Yes. I'm actually on my way to Carbondale.
Oh,
I don't know if I could pick up your station.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering if you're talking about high-mindedness and preaching democracy and that sort of stuff. I was wondering, a lot of African countries, I think of Cameroon in particular, have had this past, and that which is still with them to this day, of rampant government corruption and businesses being run away from certain territories because of all the unwritten fees, all the bribery that businesses have to do in order to set up shop, and they find out it's not worth it because, you know, there's no economic incentive in there. I was wondering if this expanded trade with China has changed the culture, the unwritten culture in a lot of these national and local level African governments. I know it's a continent of 53 people or 53 countries.
Yeah.
But
well, Serge, what do you think?
Yeah, first, it's very true that corruption is a huge problem in Africa, and I think President Obama rightly underlined that in his recent speech in Ghana. I mean, I think corruption took half of his attention during the speech, so it's really a big problem. And China coming into that, into these corrupted places, China is also corrupted in China. I mean, China is well known for officials in the Communist Party having to be bribed to get to give any license or any business doing. So there is a common culture of corruption, if you can say so. But on the other hand, what is very new with the Chinese is that in Africa is that not only they finance projects like the West has done also before, but they also built it afterwards. So because they are the same who spend the money and then get the money back through their own companies building up projects like bridges or dams or roads, somehow there is less money lost in bribes. Somehow there are less people in between, you know. The Chinese are giving and taking back the money somehow. So it has made the project been much cheaper, and it has eliminated a bit of the very big corruption that used to be there.
So you think that this lowers, in the large scheme of things, that this will lower barriers of entry for small businesses or other local...
I'm sure, yes, because, you know, Chinese are coming in Africa with a very capitalist culture, actually. And, it's not anymore about communism, about ideology. It's very capitalist. And the Chinese themselves are many entrepreneurs. Because in Africa, you see two kinds of Chinese people. You see the workers who have come for 3 years for a contract on a big infrastructure project, like a bridge, a dam, or a railway. Or you see the pioneers. I mean, people who come with a real sense of 21st century adventure. They are poor in China. They want to try their luck in Africa. They have nothing to lose, so they come and a bit with this kind of a pioneering mentality of the going to the West, even in America, you know, the conquest of the Wide West. So they come and they start very low, selling things in the street. Then they open a small restaurant, then a second one, the boutique. They import something from China. They grow the business. And I've met many of these people becoming rich ultimately. But they do impress Africans with an entrepreneurial spirit.
All right. Interesting.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's continue. We'll go next to someone on a cell phone. This is line four. Hello.
Yes, it's the same old story, it sounds to me. The spread of the disease of capitalism keeps doing its thing, and then it gets the compliments of this gentleman on your program. And it all turns out that the imperialization of the process is predictable and just as destructive as it ever has been in the last 700 years. Thank you, and I'll ring up.
Well, I suppose this raises the question as far as the Africans are concerned, the people that you've talked to, do they feel that they have benefited by having the Chinese there and having them bring their now capitalist business philosophy to the country?
Well, they have very much mixed feelings about the Chinese. First you have to consider the difference between the elite and the normal people. So in the governments, in the sideways of the parliamentary people or the governments, they really love Chinese because Chinese have given them has given to the elite, the African elite, a red carpet treatment they never had before. If you only think about this summit in Beijing in November 2006, you would see 48 head of states or head of governments coming, African coming to Beijing, being welcomed in an amazing way, being toured around in limousine in Beijing, and Chinese are very good for this. I mean, for red carpet treatment, and also they in Africa. I've been talking with a Congolese minister, and he told me this amazing anecdote. That he had once a dinner with a Chinese delegation, and actually the whole Congolese government was around the table, and between each minister Congolese, you had a Chinese band here sitting and entertaining him. But the guy who was next to the minister I spoke with told him the whole night about Greco-Roman architecture and jazz. And the minister, it was the minister of building and construction, was stunned because these are exactly his two passions. I mean, Greco-Roman architecture and jazz. And the Chinese man next to him would tell him everything about the famous architects, the famous jazz man, you know. And at the end, he spoke with his colleagues, the other ministers of Congo, and they discovered that every Chinese had studied the hobbies of the African ministers and had entertained them exactly on these topics. Mm. And later on, that Chinese delegation from Congo went to Liberia, went to South Africa, went to Zambia, and they would call the Congolese ministers from every stop on their way in Africa and would say, hello, how are you? What about the new release of CD and jazz music? And so it was amazing how organized the Chinese have been to seduce the elite. Of course, the story is completely different if you look at the normal people. Not completely. Sometimes you have people in the population who really love Chinese because they can buy more things with the same amount of money. But also you have, China is moving in Africa with a lot of its labor, its own Chinese labor. And so it is actually bitter for an African to see a Chinese man coming in Africa with a shaver and working in various basic tasks that he could do himself, and he's unemployed. So there is a resentment for that. And also, in some cases, the Chinese are obliged to hire local labor. For example, for every Chinese worker they import in Africa, they have in Nigeria, Congo, Algeria, they have to hire like two or three local workers as well. But these workers are very badly paid by the Chinese companies. They have no contract. They have no insurance. If they get injured on the working site, they are fired immediately. They get paid typically like $3 or $4 a day, and half of that amount is needed to just for the transportation fee to go to the working site and to eat there at the canteen. So it's really a bitter experience for the Africans who work for the Chinese.
We're at our midpoint here. I have some other callers we'll get right to. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Serge Michel. Until recently, he was West Africa correspondent for the French newspaper Le Monde and has worked as a journalist in Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Balkans. He's now based in Geneva. He's won France's most prestigious journalistic award for his work in Iran. His work has also appeared in a number of other places, including Fortune, Foreign Policy, The Independent, The Sunday Times. He is the co-author, along with Michel Bourret, of a newly published book here in the United States. The title is China Safari on the Trail of Beijing's Expansion in Africa. It's published by Nation Books and also contains some very interesting photographs by Paolo Woods, an award-winning photographer who went along on a lot of the time here. And so you can see some of his photos in the book. You can go down to the bookstore and take a look at it. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-945. I guess just one thing very quickly, I think it would be worth mentioning. I know that this is a project that you worked on for a long time, and that one of the things that you had to do was simply to spend time with people, to hang out with people quite a bit before they would talk with you, because, at least in part, because the Chinese, they're not overly fond of journalists, and they are not all that open to answering questions from reporters.
This is the least you can say. You know, I've been working in Iraq and Afghanistan, in Iran even recently, and I have interviewed the Taliban leaders and insurgents in Fallujah, but to be honest with you, it has never been so difficult. I mean, often it took just weeks to gain confidence of Chinese entrepreneurs, but this was very essential for writing our book, because we wanted to tell the story from within. And I must say that a lot of the coverage I saw of this topic before working on it was very anti-Chinese, and we tried to keep a balance. We tried to, but for this you need to access them. You need to go in their cars. You need to spend some time with them at home, you need to see their factories, and you need to see Africa with their eyes. And the look is very different if you look at Africa with Western eyes or with Chinese eyes. I mean, with Chinese eyes, Africa is an opportunity. With Western eyes, Africa is a place of genocide, droughts, civil wars, and a place good for nothing somehow. So it was very important for them, for us, to access the Chinese. And it took us like nights and nights, endless dinners in Chinese restaurants. We had to spend time in karaoke bars to get close to them, to approach them. So that was the story.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else here who is listening in here in Champaign, where we are, line number two. Hello.
Oh, I have a very specific question. What's the future for the micro enterprises that many of the women have? And should we decide to support them with charity funds that we can send? I'm hoping to hear about the future of that. And also, I know that it might be better to send, in the Red Heifer program, seeds to people for farming rather than cattle or goats or anything like that. Do you have any information on that?
Sorry, I couldn't understand the second half of your question.
If you decide to give money to the Red Heifer program, which is giving goats or cows or seeds, I've been told that because it's harder to sustain a cow's grazing and as animals like that, that it would be better to send seeds for farming. Do you have any information on that?
No, not really. I'm sorry, but the what I have seen there is that the Chinese presence didn't have much influence on these microfinancing schemes that are still working quite well. And frankly, one of the future of Africa are the women and entrepreneurs. They are amazing. I mean, for centuries, Africa holds on its feet thanks to the women. And I've done for other assignments, not this project on China, but for other assignments, I've seen women projects, and it's really working well. As far as the seeds or the animals are concerned, it's hard to say. It depends very much on the region. You know, you have these 53 countries, you have different climates, but there is a skyrocketing now market for alimentary for food and for food products because the prices have gone up and the Africans many African countries have made more surface available for farming. So it's clearly also a booming industry, and I think whether you help with animals or seeds, it will be useful.
All right. Again, I want to thank the caller and go on to the next. This is someone in Clay City, Illinois, line one. Hello.
Hello. My question is, when a trading partner becomes a dominant force in a market, there it has a tendency to affect the currency and the rate of exchange. I notice he keeps talking in terms of dollars. Has with the dollar slipping and all the problems we've had with the currency exchanges, has that had a major impact? I mean, do you see more yens being or more Chinese currency
yuan
being flowing around through the market, or do they transfer to whatever country they're into? What's the currency of exchange when you talk about market impact? I would think Chinese currency would become a major player in the currency market.
I haven't seen the yen, the Chinese yuan being very important for the time being, but it depends very much also on the place in Africa. I mean, you have many countries where the euro is now the biggest, the most important currency, and the euro tends to be more stable than the dollar recently. But you know, all the when you speak about oil, about raw materials, mines, and everything, it's all calculated in dollars. And apparently will remain so. So the Chinese themselves come with dollars and they trade in dollars. They are selling a lot of goods in the U.S. It brings them dollars in China. So they take these dollars and they invest them in Africa. It's a lot of this is still done in dollars. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think one of the interesting stories here is the culture clash that can happen when you get two peoples that are different and have had no experience with one another before. I think you write in the book about the fact that some of the Chinese workers who've come to Africa they've never been out of China. They may never have been out of their home province, and they certainly never laid eyes on a black person before. What are some of the experiences of the Chinese who have come into this culture that is very, very different from the place that they had grown up?
Oh, yes, it is. If you can imagine, the most two remote cultures in the world. I mean, the African culture in terms of music, in terms of way of life, and the Chinese one. In China, the most important thing is discipline and is the dedication of one person for the common good. Chinese see themselves not as only an individual, but as part of a huge machinery that has to work well. And somehow, the machinery is more important than the individual. So they are really disciplined, dedicated to the mission they have. And Africans do not have this culture. They have a more flamboyant culture. They have a more individual culture as well. And they have been influenced, obviously, by Western European and American cultures. So there is a clash, of course. And I must say that one of the reason for this clash is also that the Chinese who go to Africa, at least the workers, the very simple people, have never heard about Africa before. They have never seen a black man. Many of them had never taken a plane before going there, and they have never gone out of their province or their city. And these people, you know, in China, you don't have so many institutes for African studies. I mean, in Paris, you have every street corner an institute telling you all about Africa. In London, same thing, you know, Oriental studies or African studies. It's very common. In China, you only have one institute in Beijing, and they have 20 students. And that's all. And in terms of academical background, it's not a much. And these 20 students at that institute in Beijing, they are all busy working on risk assessments for Chinese companies going to Africa, and they have no time to really research. They don't have this exchange of scholars between China and Africa. It's starting. The whole thing is starting. But we are at the beginning of a process. And I must say that on both sides now, the people are quite cautious, and there is also some racism going on, and there is also some tensions like this.
Mm. There's the story that you tell in the book about how you were in Congo, I think, and you were walking down the street, and some Congolese children ran up and started to greet you in Chinese. And, you know, they didn't know you were French. They just knew you weren't African. So they must have thought, well, if you're not African, I guess that must mean that you're Chinese.
Yeah, that was striking. They say, ni hao, ni hao. And they believe every foreigner there is Chinese, because Chinese, that was in Congo, Brazzaville, Chinese are doing everything. They are building the roads. They are building the stadiums. They are building the new TV headquarters there. They are building the dams. And it's for them, I mean, every foreigner is Chinese, and they were very young boys, maybe 6-7 years old. So they hadn't the chance to meet French people there that used to traditionally work in Congo.
We have another caller, someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I have traveled a lot in Africa going way back, and some of the things that, and then recently too, so I was recently in Cape Verde and saw how Chinese shop workers are changing the economic landscape of that African country. And I got two different opinions. One was a fellow who was fairly well off, who thought it was a great thing that the Chinese were bringing in very, very inexpensive goods that poor farmers could finally afford. On the other hand, the Chinese were developing very nice businesses and stores, while the African merchants were being relegated to the open-air markets and were finding it very difficult to compete with the Chinese, and there was a lot of resentment that I heard from one person about that. The other thing is that I was recently actually in the Portuguese island of São Miguel during the Holy Ghost Festival, the Festival of Espírito Santo, and the whole place was closed down. It's a big, big, big festival, and except for a Chinese merchant. And there was something about that seemed absolutely wrong, that he probably figured, well, I don't care about the Espírito Santo, so I'm going to stay open for business, and there's some people who are going to want to come in and buy clothes. But I can't believe that didn't set up some resentment in the local population, that he wasn't showing respect to local beliefs. I don't know if that's going on in Africa, but I suspect that it is. It reminds me of Lebanese merchants in West Africa who created a lot of resentment. So yeah. It sounds great to me that the Chinese are doing all these big projects and helping infrastructure and so forth, but it seems to me like it's an old model that's being played out here, and it doesn't seem like it's going to end well. I'll just hang up and see what you have to say.
All right.
No, that's very true. I mean, Cabo Verde is known for having let too many Chinese in, and really they have changed the way the streets look like. The countries who benefit the most from China are also the ones who set a frame and who put some limitations to Chinese businesses, and who request Chinese to for better quality projects, for better quality migrants. For the more you ask, the more you get. And there are some countries who were taken without notice, and they just let thousands of Chinese come, and without understanding that there was maybe something to do to slow them down, or to get more, to ask them to behave differently. So yes, of course there are many problems, and the resentment is growing in Cabo Verde, for sure. In Dakar, just in front of Cabo Verde, you had local merchants, but that would demonstrate and it would put some Chinese shops on fire. But what would be here interesting, you mentioned the Lebanese, but in this fight against the Chinese, the Lebanese and the Senegalese were together, and they have kind of an organization, a union, and their union was very vocal about forbidding new Chinese merchants to come. And the resentment is also very high in Zambia. It's maybe the place where the anti-Chinese feeling is the strongest. In Zambia, the Chinese you have everything. You have Chinese farmers, you have Chinese merchants, you have also Chinese mines. They have bought copper mines in Zambia, and they employ local labor, very badly paid and so on. But they also do not respect any security measure in the mines. And as you know, in China, it's not a big deal. You have an accident every week, and 50 miners die in China every week. It doesn't even make the headlines. But in Zambia, it's different. And they had an accident in a factory producing dynamite in 2005. And they were so badly equipped, and they would hire the workers for that dynamite production on a daily basis on the gate. They would choose 50 people and come in. They wouldn't check them. They would make a body search. So the workers would come in with matches, with lighters, with cell phones that could emit, be dangerous with explosive material. And they would have 50 people working in one room that was designed for only 15 workers, and they would handle in the same place detonators and the explosive material. So that was so clearly horrifying that it had to happen, and it happened in 2005. 52 Zambians died in 1 second, and the Chinese have been very bad in compensation because they don't have the understanding of what. Of the culture, local culture. So they try to sort the problem as cheap as possible, you know, to give as less as possible to every family, because they thought we went to keep it cheap. And that was a big mistake, so it has created resentment. It has, and now you have anti-Chinese strikes in Zambia on a regular basis.
Well, this gets a question that I was wondering about. In these places where the Chinese have come in and they've had these either big construction projects or they've been doing mining, where they have brought in Chinese supervisors and also Chinese workers, and then the Africans get relegated to the worst jobs, the one that are on the lowest level of the ladder that may be very dangerous, it seems that this would be a natural opportunity for organizing workers if they already weren't organized. Something, though, I would also expect that the Chinese might not be very happy about.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing about it, not so funny, but the strange thing is that in many places in Africa, you had unions organized before the arrival of the Chinese. But and you had minimum wage, for example, in Congo, you have a low, and it's very clear. But because the government wants to please so much the Chinese, they told them, don't worry, they didn't even mention that there was a minimum wage. And they do not request the Chinese to respect their national laws, which is very bad. So the unions exist, and in some places, yes, the Chinese are giving impulse to the unionists to regroup and to find new reasons to fight. But when you have a government so obviously taking side with the Chinese, it's quite difficult.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Serge Michel, is was until recently a correspondent, West Africa correspondent for the French newspaper Le Monde, and that he's worked as a journalist in a lot of other places in addition to Africa, in the Middle East, in the Balkans. He's now based in Geneva, spending some time in the United States, talking about a book that he's co-authored. The book is China Safari on the Trail of Beijing's Expansion in Africa. It's published by Nation Books. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm continuing to think about the relations between the Africans and the Chinese people that come there to do business. The Chinese clearly are there for the long term. One wonders the kind of difficulties that we've seen, the tendency of the Chinese workers to live apart, not to live with the Africans, not to have a lot of contact with them. Probably not many manage to learn the language of the people where they're working. Do you think that is something over time that will change?
I don't know. It's very difficult to say. You know, when we see Chinese there, they live among themselves. They live in Chinese barracks. They eat Chinese food prepared by Chinese cooks with Chinese vegetables grown just outside the camp in a small garden they have. And they don't like the local culture, they don't like the local music, they don't like the local women, it's not their taste, apparently, and they don't like the local food. They really have a culture that is very, very difficult to mix. You know, China has been behind its Great Wall for many centuries, and it and some of the people, and mostly the one who go to Africa, have this mentality that they have at the same time a complex of superiority. They believe that Chinese culture is the best and is most sophisticated. The Chinese food is incomparable with other things, and they are not really ready to exchange and to try other things. Mm. On the other hand, you would see some pioneers becoming more Africans in a way. I met one of these guys. His name is Jacob Wood, and he's one of the biggest Chinese entrepreneurs in Nigeria. He is there for 30 years, so yes, it's already some time. And he speaks the local languages, and he has even gone local in the way that he is now a polygamist. He has two wives, both of them Chinese, and that's very good for him because he has one managing one hotel in the capital city and the other one managing a hotel in the main business city. He has two hotels then, and he navigates between the two cities and between his two wives, and apparently that's a very good solution for him. So some of them are making an effort to understand the local cultures, but they have a very small minority right now.
Yeah, this is quite an interesting man. As you said, this is a Chinese man. He was born in Shanghai. His name is Jacob Wood, and he apparently has been living since the 1970s, has been living in Nigeria.
Yeah.
There's a photograph of him here in the book. There's a picture here of one of the Mrs. Woods in a restaurant here with some Africa, entertaining some African people. That seems in so many ways so odd, his experience in his life.
It's odd, or it's I mean it's comic. I mean, during this trip in Africa, I mean, it took us about a year and a half to tour these 12 countries and to write the book. I mean, so many times just had desire to laugh. And you know, you see these people, and they I don't know. We went together with Mrs. Wood, the one that is on the picture. So mm-hmm. she has a restaurant of 1,500 seats on five stories. And the night that we took that picture, she was offering a banquet for the president of the Senate of Nigeria, who was celebrating his 70th birthday mm-hmm. with 300 friends. And another night of when we were there, she took us around and wanted to show us the Red Lantern District. You have to understand the Red Light District, but she says Red Lantern. And we went to karaoke with her. We saw, we sung with her. And it's so funny, you know, in the middle of in Africa, you find a small Chinese casino with everybody there is playing and is gambling, is a Chinese. It's a strange shock of cultures, and it's fun as well.
We talked a little bit at the beginning about the fact that many Western and European businesses had become disappointed and disenchanted with Africa and their involvement there and had left for a variety of reasons, and that for a variety of reasons as well, the Chinese, beginning in the mid-90s, had decided that the Chinese government began to encourage Chinese businesses to get involved in
yes.
Africa. Based on what China has been doing and some of the success that they have had, now are there people in Europe, in the United States, who are looking at that and saying, we need to go back?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, when you go to places like Angola had last year the world's highest growth rate of 27%, and it has been like this for the last 5-6 years. So when you go to Angola, the Chinese have really taken a good advance because they went there immediately after the civil war, when the West was disgusted and didn't want to enter Angola because of a lack of democracy and good governance. So the Chinese went in with billions of dollars in their suitcases for investing and reconstruction of the country, and now you would see in Luanda, in Angola, you would see delegations from America, from Brazil, from Portugal, from France, from Britain, queuing up at the airport and begging hotels to book a room. I mean, you have the waiting list for hotels in Luanda is amazing. It's about a month and a half to have even this very bad room for $500 or something.
You know, we talked about the fact that early on that many African governments were very eager to have the involvement of the Chinese and that the Chinese also were very excited about this and that they still regard it as a long-term prospect. Having said all that, have there been some places where at least the Africans have soured on the involvement of the Chinese? And is there some way in which the Chinese as well maybe have started to think that it was more complicated than they thought at the beginning?
I thought so. Yes, I think the Chinese have gone too fast. They in the last 10 years they have gone to, I don't know, let's say 40 countries out of the 53, and it's not feasible. You can't really be good everywhere and assess every situation like this. So I think they have been too fast, and now they have to consolidate a few positions. Obviously, Zambia is one of them. Angola is maybe another one because they have problems there with the local government. And I think there are places where maybe the Chinese will have to withdraw. And I think of Zambia. I mean, Zambia there was an election not far ago, and the opposition was clearly campaigning on an anti-Chinese platform. Their slogan was "China go home." So, and the opposition almost won the election, and accused the government of rigging the vote. Mm-hmm. So it was possible that if the opposition leader was elected, he would throw Chinese away.
There are some countries that still have formal relations with Taiwan, so that makes it impossible for them to deal with the PRC. Are the Chinese Taiwan, the Taiwanese Chinese, they may not have the resources, I don't know, or the interest that the mainlanders do. Are they involved in Africa?
Yeah, they're still involved in these four or five countries, but it's very difficult for them because mainland China is coming with more money, and they are really turning all Taiwan allies away from them. It's quite cruel if you think that you have Taiwanese diplomats and aid workers and doctors going to these places in Africa, staying there for 10 years, working really well because Taiwanese cooperation is very well organized and very efficient. And then you have communist Chinese diplomats coming and just buying the dictator, local dictator, and turning the country against Taiwan. We went to Taiwan also to meet some people there, and they were very bitter. Mm.
Just as a way of finishing up, we've talked about perhaps what this means for China, what it means for Africa in about 30 seconds. What does this mean for the world, do you think?
For the world, it's clearly a new world order, I believe. I mean, I believe China is now using Africa to become the world number one power.
Mm. Well, there we will leave it with the recommendation of for people to read the book, because it's a very interesting story, and as we said at the beginning, one, I think it's worthy of more coverage than it's got. If you want to read about the involvement of China in Africa, look for the book. It's titled China Safari. It's published by Nation Books, co-authored by Michel Bourré, and our guest for this morning, Serge Michel, former West Africa correspondent for the French newspaper Le Monde, also has some very good photographs in the book by Paolo Woods. Serge Michel is based in Geneva, but is now spending some time in the United States to talk about the book. And Serge Michel, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Welcome. I hope my English was good enough.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you. Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. We are WILL. And WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. We'll take a break here for an update on the markets and news. We'll be back, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, Hudsonville, Illinois, and Crescent City, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade. Soybeans are soaring today on USDA's confirmation that China purchased 1.9 million tons of U.S. soybeans this week, including 120,000 tons of old crop. Spot August, which was in first position day for August beans, actually were more than 70 cents higher at one point this morning. It's since backed off a little bit, but still a very strong day thus far. Meanwhile, wheat and corn are following and rising on spillover strength from the soybeans, as well as some weakness in the dollar that was seen this